On September 12, 1962, a youngish president took hold of the podium and began speaking in a university football stadium in my natal city of Houston, Texas. As he began his speech, he expressed his gratitude for the various leaders who had come to hear him, university officials, state and local and federal, elected officials, teachers, scientists, and the crowd who he addressed as distinguished ladies and gentlemen. The president continued to praise the university, the city, and the state, and he named the then current cultural climate as a time of both great fear and great joy. He also promised the gathered crowd that his remarks would be brief, which I suspect was welcome on a September afternoon in swampy Houston, Texas. He continued his remarks with a creative retelling of the history of creation and humanity's progress up to the current time. He stated that humanity's quest for knowledge and progress is determined and cannot be deterred. And then, a sailor himself, he began to speak of space as a new sea. His remarks are captivating and inspiring. It is at this point that he delivers these famous lines where he casts the vision, when he throws down the gauntlet to this gathered crowd and to the American people. He says, "But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why 35 years ago fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas?" As a Longhorn, I'm still sort of wondering that myself. He goes on to say, "We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard, because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one that we are unwilling to postpone, and one to which we intend to win, and the others too. At that moment in time, our country was at full stride, not without fear and great social and political challenges, but also experiencing a surge of joy and creative energy and passion and cohesion." And I suspect you may find yourself inspired by the words of that youngish president, because inspiration is contagious, and likely you might be wondering, "Jimmy, where in the H-E-C-K are you going with this?" Here's why I'm remembering this story of an inspiring political speech. I truly believe if we didn't have the fifth chapter of Matthew's gospel, the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, and all the subsequent wisdom that follows them, if we didn't have these lines that we have from our gospel this morning, the last 10 verses of Jesus' speech to this crowd gathering to hear him at the base of a mountain, if we hadn't received these lines first, Jesus' words, we would have never heard the inspiration and courage and creativity from President Kennedy. I believe we would have never experienced, lived through, enjoyed the progress of Western civilization that led us to the scientific revolution, the industrial revolution, the space race, the technological revolution that has helped humanity grow and change and flourish. In these last 10 verses from Matthew's fifth chapter, Jesus is calling all of creation and humanity into a new old way of living, into a relationship with power and love that was previously present in God but had become invisible and unavailable to humankind because of our natural myopia. Jesus is not asking us to become different people. No, he's asking us, inviting us, inspiring us to become the people we were made to be. Listen to the love and power in his words and imagine them for yourself as a reality rather than just an idea. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, give them your coat also. If anyone forces you to go with them 1 mile, go 2 miles. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Can you see that this disrupts the whole order of how we relate one to another? Do you feel how disruptive his words and concepts are to those of us who settle for right and wrong, black and white, us and them, blessings and curses? And if you do, can you not also see, can you not feel in your heart the deep part, the secret part, the soft part, the you part of your heart? Do you not feel drawn to the vision of living among God and one another that Jesus paints? The one whose end game is not justice, but mercy. The one that culminates in love rather than power. The sun shines on the blessed and the cursed. The rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous, because everybody is in. Everybody. Everybody is loved. Everybody. Everybody. Even Mike Flynn. And Mike Tyson. And Michael Moore. And Michael Jackson, Michael Jordan, Michael Vick, Michael J. Fox, Michael Phelps, Douglas, Mike Myers, Ditka, Strahan, Irvin, Singletary, Coulter, and even the Archangel Michael. Everyone, everybody, every name under heaven, everybody. Everybody is beloved, and everybody has the potential to be a lover, one who extends love and care into the kingdom. Our mission, the first one, the real one, the one that is always ours, no matter what other missions pop up in front of us and inspire us. Our mission is not in the heavens. Our mission is right here on the ground in Jackson, Wyoming. Ours is to join Jesus in the sweeping momentum of chapter 5, to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. Maybe you wish our mission was just to the moon, because of course, that would be easier. But our mission isn't our mission because it's hard or because it's in the Bible or because we go to church or because the preacher said so. Our mission is ours because we are made for it. We are built for it. We're engineered for it, created for just this mission, to spread love, to care for those who need care, to lend aid, to make a difference, to give comfort to those experiencing the deepest sorrow, to rejoice with those who have come to find real joy. One of my favorite lines ever from a book comes from an incredibly obscure Charles Bowden novel. It strikes me as something so firmly descriptive of reality, as the author describes a garden that is not unlike the one from the book of Genesis. His description ends with the discovery of a sign that is placed at the very edge of the garden, low to the ground. The sign reads, "This is the real world, muchachos, and we are all in it." Isn't that the truth? Amen.